Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
Well, welcome back to another edition of Zero Block 30. Today we have four rounds in the magazine. Round number one, the chief negotiator for the Taliban reported that a deal is done involving the closure of five U.S. bases in Afghanistan, where they're also going to withdraw 5,000 U.S. troops. Is the war over? Did we win? Well, it's hard to say, but we're going to talk about it in round one. Round number two, a historic class graduated from Ranger School last week. It included the first ever Air Force woman to complete the course and former NBA player Marshall Plumlee, who is 7 feet tall, and you can't teach that. Round number three, I sat down with former Army Ranger and Captain Will Bardenwerper, and he talked about his journey from Princeton to Wall Street to Iraq and everywhere in between. He's a fascinating dude who's seen all kinds of shit. You're going to want to listen to that interview. And finally, round number four, we are going to be working our way through the greatest book that I have ever read. The book is called The Enlisted. It is self-published, it is completely unedited, and it is a masterpiece that I cannot wait to reveal to the world. I enjoyed reading it while I was sitting around the old Lazy River this weekend, and all of that is going to be brought to you by our good friends at SeatGeek. SeatGeek is a place where you can get tickets just straight on your phone. It is college football season. Shout out to Conn School West Point, who beat Rice this week. I'm sure he was happy about that. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone. It's by far the easiest way I found to shop for tickets. I could be anywhere in just a few taps. I can instantly find seats. Do you get your seats from SeatGeek? Or you're probably a season ticket holder, huh?
I'm a season ticket holder for Army, but I use SeatGeek for a lot of other things.
Oh, you could probably use it whenever you go to fucking Michigan, right? Aren't you going this week?
Yes, I am, but my tickets were taken care of for that game as well.
Cons, can you work with me just a little bit? Fucking
you know
shit.
What I did use SeatGeek for? I used SeatGeek to get tickets for Jersey Boys. I've already seen it, but my girlfriend has not, so we will be going to see Jersey Boys, and I could not get over the amazing price that I got.
There you go, and you can get $10 off on your first SeatGeek purchase if you download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code CHAPS today. That's promo code CHAPS for $10 off the first SeatGeek purchase. You're going to find amazing deals that fit your budget, and they're going to rank every single seat because you hate to show up to a place like Fenway. You could be sitting behind a pole. You know that's not going to happen whenever you use SeatGeek, unless you want to sit by a pole. Nothing wrong with that if you want to get a super good deal like $3 or something like that. Go to SeatGeek app and enter the promo code CHAPS today. Looked at my forecast today. 10 days out, 100 degrees or above every single fucking day, man. Labor Day is a cock tease.
For
cock
you, tease. Yeah. Even for us a little bit up here, but I think overall it's a good sign of things to come, especially we have not only college football is back, but now this weekend coming up, we have the NFL is back, and it is fall in full force. So I hope the temperatures drop for you.
I can't wait to walk out the first time and feel the old nipperoons get a little hard when I walk out, because now when I walk out of my house, my glasses just fog up immediately, which is the worst. The worst.
I only like
Kate,
summer.
How was your weekend?
Yeah. Are you depressed? Summer, so I'm sad. I'm bummed. All the stupid yellow jackets are buzzing around all the trash cans now. It's terrifying to walk down the city street. They're everywhere.
I don't know, but I also think, once you're no longer in school, summer really isn't that great. Because other than, I guess you enjoy the warm weather, but it's not as though you have to go back to school or anything. Your life really doesn't change.
In a former life, I was a lizard on a hot rock somewhere, and I wish I could be that way all the time. But no, my weekend was good. I went down to, I stayed in the Philly suburbs all weekend at the 55 and up community with my parents, which, my goodness, they had to put new carpeting in the elevator because they can have little dogs there. And apparently people's dogs were scooting across the elevator carpet after coming up from the shitter area. So that was the big to-do. That was the big
excitement.
That's
a sign of anal sacs that need to be popped, Kate. You need to let them know.
Yeah, I need to put up a little poster there. Also, they had a bring-your-own-hot-dog bocce party, and my dad was the grill guy, so you brought him a hot dog. He grilled it while you played some bocce. I thought that was adorable. How do you keep the hot dogs in track? I don't know. Bring your own. Make sure you know. You got a Dietz and Watson. You got a Hebrew National. Make sure you keep them separate on the grill.
Credit to your father for taking care of that then.
Yeah.
And your dad seems like the kind of guy who would love to wear a grill instructor apron too.
Absolutely. Oh, for sure. For sure, for sure. And then final shout out, it was my goddaughter's birthday. She had an ice cream cake and two of her siblings do karate. She insisted, very Marine Corps of her, on cutting the cake with a large sword.
And, oh, I like that.
Yeah, and she nailed it.
Little young NCO in the making.
Young NCO in the making. Chopped that cake right up, so that was very nice. But yeah, lovely low-key. Still not smoking, by
the way. There we go. There we go. That's good. I had an unexpected visitor this weekend.
Ooh.
It was actually really crummy. One of my buddies from college, he texted me on Friday, "Hey, I'm at Newark Airport right now. Long story, but can I stay at your place?" Long story short, his passport is expiring in 67 days, and he was headed to Greece going through Munich. I guess Munich, and this was something I didn't realize. If your passport is expiring before, you know, in a certain amount of days, certain countries don't let you into the country. Even though the passport is still good, because it's within that window, they don't let you in, which confuses me, because what's the hell the point of a expiration date if you can't use it? So anyway, he got stranded, which ultimately meant because he couldn't get a new passport until today. So he was just with me all weekend.
Oh.
But he was a good buddy. So, I mean, it worked out. Had a, you know, unexpected guest, but
there you go.
We adapted. We had a good time.
Well, Afghanistan has had a little unexpected guest for about, 18 years
yes,
now?
Yes, they have.
The lizards like Kate that are on a hot rock chilling are going to have a lot less bombs falling on them over the course of the next couple years. Hopefully that's the case. I mean, can you imagine living in Afghanistan, dude, over the last damn near two decades? I mean, essentially 100 years, really.
Because,
constantly at war.
I mean, there was the brief window between the Russians and us. But other than that, most think about it. Every kid that's about to be like 20 years old, all they have ever known is war in their entire lives. That's all they've ever known.
That's really sad.
Crazy,
yeah, think about that.
Like, it's totally crazy. Because round number one, the United States has finally got an agreement, I guess. We haven't really confirmed it on our side, but the United States would withdraw 5,000 troops from Afghanistan and close five bases within 135 days under a peace draft that was agreed to with the Taliban, according to their chief negotiator. The deal, reached after months of negotiation with representatives from insurgent movements, must be approved by U.S. President Donald Trump before it can be signed. But it says, in quote, in principle, we have got there. The document is closed. In exchange for the phased withdrawal, the Taliban will commit not to allow Afghanistan to be used by militant groups such as Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State as a base for attacks for the United States and its allies. You would think that's like pretty common sense. Like, hey, guys, you can't just host Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State. Like, if that's the negotiating point, you should have done that years ago.
Probably. Like, oh, please, can you keep those bad people out? I have 2 points here. Number one, 135 days to close five bases seems like not nearly enough time to do anything in the military, let alone get all of that stuff that's there out of there and back to somewhere in the United States. Because I don't know where you're going to put all that stuff.
You know
honestly.
What's going to happen? A lot's going to get left behind.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to see training videos,
Al-Qaeda training videos, where they're rolling around in our vehicles and using our weapons again. That's exactly.
Definitely.
Because then, I see this as the handshake. Oh, we promise we're not going to allow militant groups to come in here and train, and it's the handshake with the fingers crossed behind the back. There's no way.
Right. Do you think that anybody who's like a leader of ISIS or Al-Qaeda the Taliban's going to be like, guys, we have this treaty. We promised that we weren't going to do this kind of shit.
And then there's a pause, and then they all have...
The Islamic State's like, damn it, the treaty! The treaty! You did it with the treaty again. Well,
That scares me, though, I'm sorry, real quick. In principle, we've got there. That doesn't give me any sort of confidence that this is going to happen.
Well, Zalmay, let me see if I can say this name, Zalmay Khalilzad, a veteran Afghan-American diplomat, said the aim of the deal was to end the war and that it would lead to reduction in violence, but there was no formal ceasefire agreement. That seems like a pretty important aspect.
I would say.
You have to have a ceasefire. It would end up being negotiations amongst Afghan themselves to agree to a settlement. He declined to say how long the rest of the roughly 14,000 U.S. troops would remain in Afghanistan after the first stage of withdrawal, although Taliban officials previously insisted that all foreign forces would leave, which I understand on their side, too. Like, right. It can't be just 5,000, you leave 15,000 behind. You got to get rid of everybody. The Afghan president has been briefed on the draft on the accord, and he said that he will look at all the details before giving an opinion, his spokesman said on Monday. So, I mean, this just feels like another line in the old rigmarole, like that we're going to reduce forces, something's going to happen, we're going to have another surge, and on and on and on and on and on. Connor, Kate, myself, we are all removed from the military. We're no longer in, obviously, or we wouldn't be able to do this podcast. But somebody who is Sergeant Jane Doe, who I follow on Twitter. I've said before that I love her tweets. She said, this is what she said about the issue that's going on there. She said, I both want a deal to withdraw from Afghanistan, and I'm disgusted at the thought of making a deal with the Taliban. But I guess that's why I'm not a diplomat. Going to have super mixed feelings about everything if the war ends in my lifetime either way. When I first came in during the Iraq surge, there was this sense among a lot of military people that Afghanistan was the, quote, real world war. It's just a war, and the military had mostly accepted at that point that the premise of invading Iraq had all been based on lies. Which is, I mean, that is a pretty predominant thought about people who went to Iraq, like myself. Like, I feel like that war was completely worthless and pointless. She goes on to say, so yeah, it meant something. I want it to mean something. But it's hard to feel like it did sometimes. We internalized this idea that the Taliban were evil, that they had no care or concern for the lives of women or children who got caught in the crossfire. They abused the Hazara, and they were brutal, vicious extremists. But that's what you do when you have to kill people. So yeah, negotiating with them is a tough pill to swallow, but at the same time, I get it, because I don't want my kids fighting in these wars.
It's really tough to swallow. And I'm just thinking about all these folks that live over there, not our forces, but their forces. Don't you think at this point they're tired of the fighting after this long? There's probably people that have been fighting almost every single day. If you're in the military, like if we were in the military here and there was a battle being waged on U.S. soil, I can't imagine you would just like rotate in and out. Like you'd rotate off the front lines and stuff, but you would just continue to fight. So don't you think on their side, too, they have to be tired of us? Or are they just that dug in and that prideful that they don't even care and they're willing to continue to fight until there's no fight left?
I feel like it's almost everybody who's ever tried to go into Afghanistan since, like, the beginning of time has failed.
Yeah.
I mean, and I feel like we have our pretty privileged lives back home. We go over there for a chunk of time, but we know we're coming back to this.
Right.
They don't have that.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
And I read somewhere that it takes three generations of peace to like fully heal from and to fully start to change from a time of war. But I don't think they're going to get that. I think someone else is going to come. I don't know. I just feel for all the innocent people there that are stuck in between with this, because they said there's one section of this you read, Chaps, that you said it would be up to negotiations among Afghans themselves to agree to a settlement. And this has happened before in Kabul. You saw the power vacuum when the Taliban pulled out, and it was among the Afghans themselves to come up with a structure. And it just, I mean, either way, people are, I don't know. It's like Sergeant Jane Doe, as you're reading her tweets, like I feel like so many people resonate, because you just feel this like, either way, it just sucks, dude.
It's not going to end well, no matter what.
And it's not like America. Like, Afghanistan is not like America, where most people in America view themselves as Americans. Like, and if the big government says we're not at war with these people anymore, you're not at war with them anymore. It's more tribal there. It's not, they don't view themselves as Afghanistan or Pakistan. Like, whenever I remember hearing stories about whenever we first went over there and there was different SEAL units were asking people what country you're from. They're like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Like, essentially,
we don't care. We're from this tribe.
We tried to put our government style and our military style and everything on them when their culture is so different that would just never work. And it's now I love saying gaggle fuck, but.
The Afghanistan war is a huge gaggle fuck. Huge.
Best case scenario.
So all these different headlines that come across that say that we have reached a deal with the Taliban makes it seem like we're going to pull out. Doesn't feel that way. Right?
Doesn't feel that way, but I think at this point, that's what I personally would want. I just don't want to hear any more people on our side losing their lives over there. That really just doesn't sit well with me at all, as I'm sure it doesn't sit well with anybody. And, you know, at this point, we've heard so many different times, all right, we're leaving, we're leaving, we're leaving. So until everyone's back and all those bases are shut down, I don't believe it, unfortunately. Yeah. Which is a negative stance to take, I know, and I'm usually the positive one, but...
But it's a Tuesday after Labor Day weekend. Proof's in the pudding. The weather's getting cold. We're just sad.
Yeah, we're sad. Let's move on from that story. I don't feel... I have a feeling that we'll be able to talk about it plenty of times over the next couple months if we are actually...
Yeah, we're going to have a recurring segment. Afghanistan, yeah. Where are we?
Are we done this week or are we not?
Are
Let's
we done
move on
now?
To round two. Round number two, a 7-foot-tall former NBA player graduated from Ranger School this week alongside of the first woman in the Air Force to complete the grueling Army Small Unit and Tactics course. So you have two people who are making an amazing accomplishments to come in. One of them will start with Marshall Plumlee first. He's one of the Plumlee brothers who, if you follow Plumlee brothers, so if you follow college basketball at all, you've heard of the Plumlee brothers. He was part of the 2015 NCAA championship team. He played for the New York Knicks. After that didn't work out, he decided to join the Army because, shocking to me, I wouldn't think that you would have time to be a member of the ROTC while you were playing Duke basketball, because both of those required a good amount of your free time.
Yeah, I mean, I just from everything I understand about ROTC, it's pretty daily that you have requirements that you have to handle. And when you're playing for someone like Duke, or any Division I basketball program, there's a significant amount of travel, especially if you're Duke and you're going deep into the tournament every year. So he might have had to make some sort of special arrangement with his ROTC unit. Like, hey, I want to do this. Oh,
those ROTC captains can be hard us, too.
Yeah.
You've seen the text messages. So imagine old Marshall's texting his platoon sergeant and be like, hey, I can't be at PT. I got to go play Syracuse in Syracuse.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, absolutely not, little devil dog. You're going to be out here or your ass is grass.
So good on him to be able to balance that and figure that out and continue to do it, especially when he got drafted into the NBA. And instead of continuing on in the NBA, he decided, like, okay, all right, I'm going to fulfill this now, my military career. Very
yeah, I think it's pretty cool, although it does look funny in the pictures whenever he's 7 foot tall, standing head and shoulders literally above everybody else. And he said that people look up to him, whether figuratively or literally, because he's a former NBA player and things like that. I think that kind of challenge will be difficult when he gets to his first unit, because there is almost a sort of, if you are an NBA player, you come from a Duke pedigree, that you've been pampered. And I don't think that that will ingrain you or endear you, rather, to your enlisted soldiers, that you're a Duke guy, you played for the Knicks, what do you know about my struggle situation? Do you think that'll happen, Cons?
Certainly. I think coming in with that name, he will have those expectations, being a former national champion and then professional athlete. They will expect a lot of him. I think he will endear himself to his soldiers with the stories he will tell. But here's something that's interesting. He didn't make millions of dollars playing in the NBA. He only made about $620,000, which
that's a bigger enlistment bonus than you would get for
last I checked, I haven't been a second lieutenant in a while. That's a little bit more than you get as a second lieutenant, even including BAH. But
so that's essentially what it would take you. You would make that in your first 15 years, probably, on the enlisted side.
Yeah, probably.
Total?
Probably. So, but I think that's going to be a misconception. They just hear a professional NBA player. They're like, oh, this dude's a millionaire. What's he doing? He's soft. He's definitely not a millionaire. And I respect him for wanting to continue his military career.
Yeah, any person over 6 foot who volunteers to join our military, knowing that they're going to be crammed in small planes
and small Humvees, yeah,
especially if you're 7 feet, my goodness, I feel like no amount of money is going to make you comfortable no matter what you do.
No.
But yeah, I think it's really cool. His mom, who also played college basketball at Purdue, pinned his tab on, and, you know, going from the NBA to active duty Army, because initially he went from college to the National Guard.
Yes.
And so that's how he was able to still,
yep,
he was still doing the NBA stuff, but he was also National Guard. So now he's full-time Army. So he said it was part of his dream as a kid. So both the NBA and the Army were his dreams, and he's made both happen. So good for him. I think that's really
cool.
And
I also don't understand the commitment side. Like, wouldn't he have had a full scholarship just for basketball?
Maybe, like, maybe not. Think.
But he had just always wanted
to. If he was good enough to get drafted and play for the Knicks, he was definitely good enough to be a scholarship player.
Yeah, no, he's probably on scholarship, and he probably just wanted to do ROTC, not to get the break on the tuition, but just because he really wanted to serve. And that's evident now because, honestly, if he really wanted to, I'm sure he could go find a college coaching job somewhere or an NBA job or office job somewhere. So the fact that he just pushed that all aside and said, all right, I'm going to go fulfill my Army duty and just run the intramural basketball league at, you know, Fort Benning or wherever he's stationed.
He didn't get a, he did not get a scholarship for either, actually. He worked at DP Doe's the whole time. Mm. He worked a double shift making strombolis and stuff. So he was really, really hardworking guy.
Side note. When's the last time you guys had one of those pizza with the crust on the top and the bottom from Sbarro's?
You mean a calzone?
No, it's like the actual pizza with top and bottom.
Is this a trick question where we admit we've gone to Sbarro's and then you're like, you dumb bitch. Sbarro's is gross. I'm not admitting nothing.
I actually used to love those, the double stuffed, the double crusted. You know what I'm talking about, Bren, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm a New Yorker. That's tourist food.
That's sacrilege.
Lib don't go to Sbarro's.
Yeah. It's not like I'm fucking going to New York and like I'm Michael Scott. Got to go get me a New York slice.
How embarrassing.
That's what it sounds like to me.
How embarrassing.
Going to my favorite New York slice.
Wow.
They have one in the Jacksonville airport, though.
Kate, how do you know about DP Doe? Because as far as I know, the only DP Doe I know of is at the University of Delaware. Shout out Blue Hens.
Yeah, I have one in my college neighborhood.
Guess where I got my first fake ID taken?
University of Delaware?
Sure did.
Oh, in good old Newark.
I've put in work at colleges across this country, okay? I've eaten at a few DP Doe's. All right.
I thought it was unique to University of Delaware. I didn't realize it was a chain that was other places.
Not true.
All right, the next story that was significant at the same exact graduation was First Lieutenant Chelsea Hypes. She is an Air Force security officer. She graduated from the two-month course on Friday in a ceremony at Fort Benning, Georgia. She is the first woman since 1955 to graduate from this course from the Air Force, which is an incredible accomplishment. More than two dozen women have graduated the course since it opened to them in 2015 as part of the push to get women into combat jobs. But she is the first airman to do it, which is a huge deal. And she's going to have big vagina energy whenever she gets back to her Air Force base.
300 airmen have done it over the course of history, but she's the only woman. And you're right, in general, less than half the men who try to get their Ranger tabs complete it. Many fail in the first 3 days, they're out. So, you know, kudos to her. She's fucking badass.
she might be one that has to carry her graduation certificate in her wallet whenever she goes places. Because you see the Air Force, even when you just see the Air Force uniform and you see something like a Ranger tab on that, you're going to be like, how did this happen? Because when I would meet Marines that had one, I'd be like, how the fuck did you go to Ranger school? Because you don't get that opportunity a lot, let alone being a lady in security forces, having a Ranger tab would come off looking quite weird. There's definitely going to be some attempted Stolen Valor YouTube videos on this lady.
Stolen Valor. And also, you know, people don't realize for whether it's like a sniper course or Ranger school or whatever, there's usually like a tryout for it, just like for a sports team.
Yeah, they don't just send anybody.
They don't just send you.
You don't just get the sign up.
They call them NDOCs, and she completed it's an assessment. She completed last year a 19-day assessment, and she completed it last fall in San Antonio, Texas, and she was one of 10 to finish out of a starting group of almost 30. So even then, that was tough enough on its own, and they really push you there, too, to see if you're even worth going. So she did. So really, really cool. Love that.
And then she had to go on to a two-week program with the 25th Infantry Division in Hawaii to further prepare. That's what the Air Force said. Which is pretty incredible that she accomplished all that. So shout out to her.
Well,
big time accomplishment. There are going to be a lot of airmen who look up to her in the near future.
The crazy part, too, was that at the very end of this Ranger school, they made her play one-on-one against Plumlee. And she actually beat him, too. So she's just really impressive.
Probably
lady.
Dunked on him.
She dunked on him. So that's what I heard. So that's
did a
facts.
Little bit of a slam dunk.
Indeed.
All right, let's move on to round number three.
Real quick. Because no matter who you talk to, whether it's a CO, whether it's a Ranger, everybody always says that school is the hardest school in the military. I need to once and for all get a definitive list of the most difficult schools in the military, be it Ranger school, SEAL training, rescue swimmer training, as depicted in The Guardian starring Ashton Kutcher and Kevin Costner, or whatever. I need to know what is the hardest.
I would say the hardest schools are the ones you got to stay awake through PowerPoints in. So I'd say like admin school.
Yeah. MP yep. School would be up there, I think.
Okay.
Tough Fort to say.
We'll put a list together, definitively. But not until you two.
Obviously, Khan's graduating from the Air Force Academy. That's tough.
Right. This has to
tough
be.
Just to even get into.
He was Air Force, but he didn't become a Ranger, you know? Yeah, so, yeah. Wow. Yeah. Your service still counts.
Kind of. Round number three is going to be brought to you by our friends at CBDistillery.com. I'm a huge CBD fan. If you've got health concerns and you need to see what CBD can do for you, CBD may offer many of the health benefits of marijuana, but without the high, CBD is 100% legal, requires zero prescription when you shop at CBDistillery.com. They've got a bunch of five-star reviews, which if you don't have a five-star review, if you go, let me say this. What's your cutoff where you won't buy something from like Amazon or someplace that does stars?
Anything below four.
Oh, Kate.
I'm a wild card. I'll take a chance on anything. But
maybe like
no, I'm
3.7.
No, you know what it is when it comes to food? I'm a five star. If it has less than 4.5, I'm like, it's out. So yeah.
For Amazon, my threshold is 4.4.
Oh, yeah.
If the average review doesn't go 4.4, because think about how many people just go to a website straight off the bat, and if you don't like what you get, you're much more likely to go back and say this is bad than say this is good.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I mean,
yes.
I'll never go to a restaurant and Yelp review like, oh, the pizza that I had at the Sbarro's with the double crust on top, that shit was delicious. But if I get a bad one, I'll fucking go there in a heartbeat. So having a 4 or 5 star review is pretty impressive for a company like CBD Distillery. That's where we get all of our stuff, whether it's going to be the pills, the oils, whatever you want to get. You can get it all from there. Go to CBDDistillery.com. Use the promo code ZBT for 20% off. Again, enter ZBT for 20% off at CBDDistillery.com. You can get everything that you have, even a little bit of a bath bomb. If you want a bath bomb, they are wonderful, they are refreshing, and they make your entire body smell like lavender. Go check it out. All right, now on Zero Block 30, I'm glad to have it. So let me just preface by say how I found Will, or I guess how Will was presented to me. I always like to ask who are some of the influential people that you follow on military Twitter, because it gives us fresh insight to new people. A lot of the same circles like that I follow, you just get the same people over and over again. Then I came across our next guest, which is Will Bardenwerper. And Will's story is incredibly interesting. I want to start just from the beginning. I always think folks who went to a school like Princeton are outside of their mind when they joined the military. Your story is different too, because not only were you a Princeton grad, you didn't go fresh in. You had a job in finance in Manhattan, and then you joined. Can you kind of walk us through what your family was thinking after you joined?
Sure, yeah. So I graduated Princeton in 98, and like a lot of Princeton graduates, I sort of made my way to Wall Street, not necessarily because I had a passion for finance, but there were some good jobs and I didn't know exactly what else I wanted to do. And so I'd been there about 3 years when September 11th happened, and I was working in Midtown. And, you know, I'll never forget, like a lot of other people, it was on, we had a lot of bank of CNBC screens on TV. It was kind of a trading floor atmosphere. And we saw the planes hit, and we actually evacuated my building. It was one of the highest buildings in New York, and they didn't know at the time how many more planes might be out there inbound. That basically was the catalyst for my decision to join the military. I had enjoyed what I had been doing in New York, but I don't know if I was totally fulfilled by it. And then, you know, once the attacks occurred, that kind of provided the inspiration to take a step back and kind of reassess what was important to me. And I concluded that the military would probably be the best way to serve.
And I think that's very interesting, because you hear a lot of that story from the enlisted side, where people just getting out of high school, they know that this is a decent job path for them to take. I think it's a whole nother situation whenever I think about folks who had good jobs, who are doing great things already in like their personal lives, and then look at the challenge of the military and take that on. Whenever you told your family, was there any like pushback? Like, are you sure this is what you want to do? Like, are you crazy? Like, there's an actual war going on?
Yeah, for sure. My father was relatively supportive. Both my grandfathers had served in World War II. And I think, you know, maybe a part of him had regretted not having served in the Vietnam era. My mom, not so much. I think like a lot of mothers, you know, she had that maternal instinct for, you know, protecting her children. And the idea that I was going to voluntarily put myself in harm's way, she was not a fan of. I mean, she was supportive of me, but she wasn't necessarily supportive of that particular decision. And just to tie back into, you know, your initial observation about, you know, joining from a place like Princeton, there's kind of one funny little story at basic training. For some reason, I ended up at Fort Jackson, even though most OCS people end up at Fort Benning because that's where OCS is. And I was cleaning a latrine one night, you know, as kind of one of the additional basic training assignments. And there was another guy in there, and he looked a little older, and I was a little older at the time. We were both about like 25, 26. And so, you know, he asked me where I was from, and I said, yeah, you know, I was working in New York. I'd gotten out of college. And he said, oh, where did you go? And, you know, in some parts of American society, having gone to Princeton is kind of a good thing. But like you said, in the military, it's kind of looked upon suspiciously by a lot of people. And so I kind of tried to hide it. I'm like, oh, you know, I just went to this school in New Jersey. And he said, oh, yeah, you know, same here. I went to college up in Connecticut. And I said, oh, you know, where did you go? And he said, Yale. And I said, oh, I went to Princeton. And so the idea that, you know, this Yale guy and a Princeton guy ran into each other scrubbing the floor in a latrine at Fort Jackson was not something that, you know, I certainly would have expected. But it just shows, you know, that you know, there really are, you know, all types of people out there doing this. And he's actually become a friend that I still remain in touch with.
Yeah, I think those kind of friendships, you just happened so naturally. I remember riding on a bus, a platoon bus, and one of our brand new second lieutenants had just joined the Marine Corps as well. He was fresh off, like, from TBS and all that. And we asked him where he went to school, and he was like, I went to Yale. And we're like, what the fuck are you doing here with us? Like, go get a good job, man. What are you doing?
And of course, every time you screw something up, you hear, oh, you know, they didn't teach you that back at Princeton, did they?
Oh, yeah. Especially from, like, your senior enlisted advisors and things that. But you took it, and you didn't do anything like PAO or finance. You went straight, and you became Ranger qualified, correct?
That's right, yeah.
So can you walk us through what, because not only did you join the Army, but you're doing something very difficult, and you actually led people where I was at the same time. I believe we were in Anbar province together at the same time in 2007. Can you kind of describe what Anbar was like for you in 2007?
Yeah, so actually we deployed to Tal Afar originally in January of 06, and then our brigade got bumped down to Anbar about 4 months in. Most of the brigade ended up in Ramadi in early 06. My battalion got kicked out to Hit, which is a town kind of about 2 hours to the northwest of Ramadi. Basically the same general situation, just a smaller place and a smaller unit assigned to it. And as you know, Anbar at the time was rough. That was right when there was actually that Marine intelligence report that got leaked to the Washington Post that the headline was Anbar is lost. And I remember we were there and I read it and I thought to myself, you know what? You know, I think this guy's right. I mean, everything that was in that report seemed to be accurate. We had a lot of casualties. You know, I think our battalion of 700 had somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, 150 to 200 wounded. And, you know, the people there didn't particularly care for us. They either were actively hostile or neutral at best, because there were a lot of former Saddam Ba'ath Party people. Al-Qaeda Iraq was very active. So it was, you know, it was a rough place in what was one of the rougher years of the war.
And I remember talking to people who I served with, a lot of dog handlers who were down in Ramadi at the same time. And whenever you talked about Ramadi in 2006, and Fallujah 2006, and the areas in between, it was just basically referred to as the Wild West. It was like being in the Wild West. You knew that almost every day, whenever you rolled out, the odds of you getting into a firefight were pretty high, because a lot of other places at that time, if you were deployed, you could have a couple days in between action. That wasn't the case in Ramadi and Fallujah.
That's absolutely right. I mean, in Tal Afar, we were there for 3 or 4 months. And, you know, looking back on it, you know, those 3 or 4 months were unbelievably quiet compared to what we were about to experience.
Did that shape you as... So I always talk about whenever I was in Fallujah, it kind of shaped my worldview, like how my deployments and things like that shaped who I was as a person. It shapes my sense of humor and how I cope with different things that were difficult. Looking back now as a journalist and covering serious issues, did your time in Ambar shape who you were as a person now?
Yeah, I think in one big way that I think is both good and bad, and I think probably a lot of service members and veterans, you know, kind of maybe can relate to this, but it definitely kind of instilled a very much of like a sort of a carpe diem, seize the day mm-hmm. philosophy, because, you know, over there, you just never really know what day is going to be your last. And you see other people who are, you know, fine one day and the next day they're blown to pieces. And so getting out, you know, I think it really, you put a premium on just kind of getting the most out of every day that you're alive. And I think that can be good in that it makes you really appreciate the blessings that you have. I think it can be not so good in that it doesn't necessarily lead to, you know, good long-term financial planning or career decisions necessarily. Yeah. Because, you know, I think you can be very focused on the present and not the long-term future. And, you know, and it can also lead, you know, I'm sure like with some people to, you know, probably unhealthy stuff, you know, with regard to drinking and partying and stuff like that, just because you kind of want to get the most out of every moment you have, which can be healthy or unhealthy depending on kind of which direction you choose to take.
No doubt about it. And I say all that, like talk about your history and your background to kind of lead us into the point with what you're doing with your career now. Cause I found it very interesting when I looked at the book that you wrote on Saddam Hussein, I had automatically assumed that you were one of the people who guarded Saddam, because I think it's very interesting that you have the background of being Ranger qualified, being a former captain in the army, doing things yourself. Seeing someone who was in that role covering other people is very, very different in military book circles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, so I wrote this book, even though I was over there when Saddam got killed. And I actually remember we went on a patrol and I remember thinking, you know, the shit could really hit the fan today when this goes down, mm-hmm. because a lot of these people were fans of Saddam. Luckily, it actually ended up being a pretty uneventful, quiet day. But yeah, I did this book entirely as a journalist, you know, interviewing the people that did participate, because that was going on hundreds of miles away. I didn't have any personal role in it. I mean, I think my experience maybe informed my perspective a little bit. And it certainly really helped me to develop a rapport with some of the soldiers who I was interviewing, who may have not trusted, you know, a journalist from a different background as much as they did someone who they knew had, you know, gone through some of these same experiences. So it helped, but you're right. I came at it from a very different angle.
What did you find like throughout the entire process? Was there anything that you felt almost sympathetic for Saddam after covering the story for so long and hearing about his last days, you as just a human being talking about another human being? Were you surprised at any of the emotions that you felt?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I should first say that, you know, the book wasn't meant to kind of rehabilitate his image, you know, so I'm not suggesting he wasn't a terrible human being that had done unspeakably bad things. And I think I make that clear in the book. But what also comes through in the book and what came through to these soldiers was the fact that, you know, they hadn't personally seen any of these bad things he had done. They mm-hmm. just saw an older, you know, man in a jail cell who they basically spent 24 hours a day with, who they conversed with because he could speak English when he wanted, and who they got to know. And some of them, you know, he was like, they said, you know, he reminded me of spending time talking with my old grandfather. You know, that was the Saddam they saw. Clearly that was only one side of him, but I think, you know, what that communicated to me was the fact that it's more difficult to be responsible for the death of someone you've kind of grown to know as a human being, joked with, watched eat, as opposed to, you know, shooting at an anonymous target 300 meters, 200 meters away that you've never seen before and you're never going to see again. Seeing someone as a human put a different, you know, it made the experience that these soldiers had much different from what most soldiers do.
And did you get any blowback for that? Because I think whenever you have like the Iraq war and the war in Afghanistan, a lot of people in the military community want to look at these people as just pure demons, essentially. Like mm-hmm. they want to completely demonize every aspect of their life. And then they read this book where they think about the soldier and the human side. Was there any blowback from the military community? Like, why are you doing this type of thing?
Not a lot that I personally got. I mean, there were some comments, you know, you'll see on different websites, you know, Goodreads and whatnot, where people put feedback to books they read. And in some cases, I think it was just clear they actually hadn't read the entire book because they said things
that
just,
right?
you know, they just weren't accurate.
Worst when you're the writer too. Like somebody will see the headline and they'll be like, "Oh, this take is terrible." I'm like, did you even fucking read it, man?
Yeah. So I mean, those ones were, you know, somewhat aggravating, but there were some more thoughtful responses along the lines that you had, you know, and I think that's a natural response that you can have reading this. I think, you know, I kind of sympathized with these soldiers to some extent in that, you know, I often drew the contrast between coming home from, let's say, the Bin Laden mission, to take the biggest one. You know, you put a bullet in the head of this, you know, evil incarnate, you come home and kind of everyone lives happily ever after. And it's a great story to tell at the neighborhood bar. This Saddam story is much more challenging because these guys come home and they're sitting at the local bar and, you know, some guy asked them, "Hey, what were you doing in Iraq?" And they said, "Oh, you're not going to believe it, but I guarded Saddam." And the person's initial reaction is going to be, "Wow, that's great. You know, that must have been really satisfying to have, you know, to have played a role in his being brought to justice." And these guys would, I think, agree, but then they would also feel somewhat uncomfortable because of the fact that they had kind of grown to like him in a very weird way. Which is a lot harder to explain to most people that weren't over there experiencing what they experienced. So I think their story was certainly a harder one to tell. And the audience for it wasn't as natural as the audience for like a more conventional story like the Bin Laden one, for example.
And I think that you get that not just in military circles, but if you talk to any correctional officer who spent time on the Green Mile, like some of these people obviously, well, all of them did horrific things, but you can develop almost like a bond just because you're with them every day.
Yeah. I mean, that was what was the most surprising to me when I first began research. Well, there were a few things that were surprising. One was the fact of just how young these guys were. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking junior enlisted for the most part, you know, 18 to 24, maybe one or two that were a little older than that. They're not, you know, CIA.
So young that you might not specialists. Even believe them if you're at a bar. And like, yeah, I just came back. Yeah. I was guarding Saddam. Like, dude, you could barely fucking grow facial hair. No, you didn't.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of them had, I think he had been in basic training like 6 months before he found himself sitting across from Saddam 12 hours a day.
God, you know, that's. And I would never believe that story. If there is a kid that looked like that, 20 years old, they reached out to me like, "Hey, Chaz, I'd love to come on ZBT. Just got done guarding Saddam." I'm like, get the fuck out of here, man.
No, Yeah, it's crazy. And then the fact just how intimate their relationship was, you know, they were literally sitting a few feet from him. They had to be, I think they said, within lunging distance, you know, in the event that he tried to hurt himself so that they could intervene. And there's nothing else to do. I mean, you're just sitting in a cell or you're sitting in a little outdoor rec area, you know, 5 feet from this guy for hours on end. So naturally they're going to talk. And so that was, I think, what went a long way towards their developing these very sort of peculiar relationships.
Isn't that a bizarre thing too, that we do as a society where you have somebody who is sentenced to the death penalty and like, no, you're not allowed to kill yourself. You have to wait until we do it.
And that was what they had a hard time with psychologically, because, you know, their mission basically was to take good care of him, because everyone knew that if he shows up in court with a black eye or you know, looking like he's starving or whatever. Yeah, they're going to say, this was not long after Abu Ghraib. People are going to say, you know, he's being mistreated. It would cause a huge international uproar. So, yeah, just like you said, their mission is basically take as good of care as possible of this guy. But he's going to be killed, you know, when you're done with this mission. So it's a very strange, I think, situation that they found themselves in psychologically.
Whenever you talk to them and it was all over, do you think that it kind of messed with them and they struggle with it years later?
Yeah, you know, so at the end of it, at the end of the book, I kind of track down where they all are today and kind of how they got there and how this experience impacted that route. And, you know, not all of them have had issues, but certainly some have. You know, there's one who's, I think, on 100% PTSD. Another one I just got word just within the last few months is back in jail. He had been homeless, got into some drug problems, arrested, had been in jail, been released from jail. And then I guess just recently got locked back up, which is kind of a sad story. Although strangely enough, this is one of those things you just can't really make it up. But he said he drew strength serving his prison sentence from having observed Saddam deal with his prison sentence. So here you have an American soldier in an American jail that is using Saddam in a weird way as kind of, you know, inspiration to get through his jail time.
So that was that's your big book. And it's great. I actually got it, I think, whenever we first started talking about 2 weeks ago, and I went through it in the bathtub. Like I usually read my books. I just reading about Saddam's prison sentence while I was in the bathtub. But recently, as an Army Ranger yourself, whenever you went through, now you're covering what's going on with Ranger School. Can you walk us through what you're doing there?
Yeah. So I did a long, 10,000 word feature article for Outside Magazine that is hopefully going to come out here sometime in the next 3 or 4 months. And what I did was I just went back to Ranger School 15 years after I graduated and basically went from start to finish with a class.
So if you were 25 at the time, you went through Ranger School at essentially 40 years old?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. So I didn't do everything that they did. Obviously, I wasn't crawling through the mud and getting hazed to quite the same extent that the current students were, but I went out on a lot of the patrols and just tracked their experience from day one to graduation. And in the course of doing that, I wove in a few of my own memories and how things may have changed, may have not changed, and just focused on kind of what it takes to succeed there, what attributes I observed in the people that were doing well and the people that were maybe not doing so well. And so hopefully, people can kind of read that and have a much better understanding of what really takes place at schools like that.
Was there an aspect about that was therapeutic for you almost, to like be back here, take a deep breath, where it's almost nostalgic?
Yeah, in a weird way. I mean, it's certainly a lot more fun to watch that than to participate in that. and honestly, I was not the best Ranger student. I graduated by the skin of my teeth. I had a really tough time, as do, probably a lot of people. It's not easy. And so it was interesting for me to kind of see maybe the areas that the top performers excelled in that I was weaker at, that maybe even at the time I didn't fully understand why I wasn't doing as well, but watching them today, I'm like, oh man, that's what it takes. And maybe that's what I was kind of missing back then. One of the biggest things I took away was how always looking to be helping others proactively not only helps the group, but it actually helps the individual because it keeps you out of your own head. I remember just so much time just kind of wallowing in my own discomfort and my own misery, whereas the people that really did the best were the ones who were so active as far as trying to help their teammates that they didn't have time to feel sorry for themselves.
That's, I wish that there's times where I look at how my leadership philosophy and how my philosophy about life is now and how different it was from whenever I was in the Marine Corps, and almost wish I could take myself now, my brain now, mm-hmm. what I've learned, and put myself back in that position and how much a better Marine I would have been. I'm sure you had that thought as well. Like, oh, I wish I would have known this at the time.
Yeah. And people, would say it, but until you kind of step back and can observe it, it's hard to internalize that lesson. And then what the battalion commander at 4th Ranger Training Battalion, which was the first phase down at Fort Benning, he said in his opening talk to the students, he said, listen, this is an interesting military school in that only the first 3 days are a personal assessment of your own capabilities. They have physical fitness tests, land navigation tests, a whole battery of individual tests just to essentially make sure you're capable of going through the rest of the course. But from day 4 through day 63, your success or failure is going to be determined by how well of a team player you are, how well you can lead, and how well you can contribute to a team. And that really is the case to an extent that I probably did not fully appreciate back when I was going through it.
Another article that you wrote that I want to bring up because the Mets are in the news now. And in 2008, you wrote an article entitled "Iraq or the Mets, What's the Difference?" And it's amazing that the same storylines are taking place in both areas. Still, do you still see the comparison of Iraq and the Mets?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I wish I could say no. I have a 2-year-old son now, and I'm part of me is reluctant to inflict on him the same sports teams that have caused me so much anguish over the years. So we're going to have to see what we can do about that.
Yeah. And both battles are still going on 18 years later. It's crazy. Will, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people follow your work or get your book?
My website's just my name, www.willbardenwerper.com. And the book can be bought pretty much most bookstores, amazon.com, online, pretty easy to get.
And follow you on Twitter where?
At W. Barden Werper.
There you go. Will, thank you so much for joining Zero Block 30.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Brought to you by our good friends at ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is the best way to get somebody to fill the positions in your job. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers, there it is again, who post through ZipRecruiter or who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just the first day. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free at ZipRecruiter.com/zero. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zero. ZipRecruiter.com/ZERO. ZipRecruiter, it is the smartest way to hire. Make sure if you have a small business of any kind, maybe you're opening up your own CBD business and you need to find people who can work for you, go to ZipRecruiter.com/zero.
All right, round number 4. Quick shout out to some military ladies who slid into my DMs with what I think chaps would say is the crown jewel of military literature. They slid in with a book by an enlisted Marine named Dathan Beach, which sounds like a something that we would storm in Okinawa or something like that, Dathan Beach. But it's basically, you go to the guy's Amazon site, it's the enlistment, not your typical military story. And it's just a guy, an enlisted Marine, who's like, I'm going to write a book. I have no formal training in any way. I'm clearly not even going to correct the spelling or punctuation marks. I'm just going to write a book. And gosh darn it, he did. The only review on Amazon just calls the guy, I think it says, shut up, boot, is the only review on Amazon. But these ladies slid into my DMs. Pooley Jones brought this to everyone's attention, and this book has blown up. And chaps, much to my delight, you actually went online and purchased it.
I might have been like either the first or second purchase of this book, and I absolutely love it. When Kate says that, so I read it around the Lazy River this weekend whenever I was there, and I stopped myself because I don't want, it's one of those books where I don't want to read too much. It's like binging a TV show.
Yeah, you want to
savor
it.
Where you fall in love with a new TV show and you want to keep it and you want to have it and have new episodes. I don't want to go through it too quickly because there's so many jewels that are in here. But when she says that there's, that he didn't edit anything, I mean, he didn't even run it through Microsoft Word.
Yeah.
Can you read the back of it so people know a little bit about this book?
Yeah. So here's the back cover. Oh, man. He says, and it's going to sound like I can't read again because the grammar is just so bad it's hard to put together. But bear with me. He said, if you're offended by this book, then I have achieved my goal. I started this project the last few months of my life in the Marines. I had never seen anyone really share typical experience of the military. Most stories you read or hear are of heroic deeds that very few have done. Well, I in no way mean to disrespect those guys and their stories. They're mostly notable and noble, but fact of the matter is that they're not common. Most guys come in and do their time, party, drink, and live like frat boys most of the time. I showed a few guys the bits and pieces of this while I was writing it, and they liked it, so whatever. Next thing you know, I'm on Amazon publisher doing a cover for my book. If you got this far, might as well read a few pages. You'll probably lose a few brain cells, but what the hell, full send.
And I love him. He says he just, for on the back cover of a book description, to be like, hey, whatever, man, whoops. And then the front cover, he's like, yeah, I made the front cover on the thing. The title of the book, it's fuzzy ass terrible, like back in the day camera photo.
It looks like it's taken from a Motorola Razr.
Motorola Razr in a dark Marine Corps ball. Like, it's really dark. They're in the blues. And then the title of the book covers their faces.
It just says the enlistment is the title. There's so many things in here, but it's so beautiful. I was texting you guys this weekend when I was sitting there reading it. It does remind me, like, if you just randomly go grab a Marine by their smoke pit or whatever, and you're just like, tell me how you joined the Marine Corps.
Yep.
Let's pick up. I'm going to start just at the very, chapter one. I want everybody to honestly read this, and I've already reached out to Dathan. I'm supposed to interview him on tomorrow. I'm supposed to interview him on Wednesday, so he might be on the show on Friday. I hope he doesn't back out, but this is incredible. Here we go. around August. No, let me start. I want to pick the perfect start. And it just doesn't do it. Just it reads like PFT commenter would have wrote it, but I think it's serious. If it ends up being satire or he did this on purpose, this guy is a genius. Because I think this book.
What are the chances that's the case?
No, none. I looked into it.
I don't want to say none. I'm going to say
2%. I don't want to say none because of what you said earlier with how many spelling mistakes there are. Microsoft Word picks up all of those. Even if it corrects it to the wrong word, everything's spelled correctly. So the fact that he just left it as is tells me that there's part of me that thinks maybe he did this on purpose, in which case, bravo. But either way, it's a great read.
All right, so here's this part, one of the very first things that he write. But this isn't the story of my high school experiences. This is about my enlistment, back to the bread and butter. Shortly after determining I did not want to clean pools forever, I went to the Great Lakes with my mother to watch my brother graduate from Navy boot camp. I'll never forget seeing how proud my family was of him and just the overall swagger he had to him compared to himself prior for leaving for boot camp. So, with two O's, after we visit him and all that good stuff, we went back to our hotel room that night. My mother and grandmother went out, and I just decided to stay home. So then he talks about his first experience, like Googling how to join the Marine Corps and shit like that. So he goes to a gas station and finds one of the little recruiter's cards that's just sitting at the gas station. And he says, "So I called the number on the card and was greeted by Sergeant Cruz in the smoothest, most confident tone I've ever heard. 'Good afternoon, Sergeant Cruz, United States Marines. How can I help you?' I answered in my awkward teenager voice, hi. I was thinking about joining the Marine Corps. I don't know, sir." Not going to spell out the whole conversation because I can't spoil the recruiter man's magic powers, but he had me hook, line, and sunk me. But what really impressed me is how fast he wanted me to come in, literally on my way home the next day. I'm talking, I was literally in my cool pool clothes. For cleaning pools, you don't typically wear business casual clothes or nothing. Pretty much a tank top, basketball shorts, flip-flops, or whatever. But Sergeant Cruz pretty much said it was okay that I came in looking like a bum. I was sitting in the parking lot staring, and my heart started to pound a million times. They tell you that the yellow footprints is the moment that your life changes. Let me tell you now, that's bullshit. The moment you walk into a recruiter's office is... Regardless of how you come in the military, at one point you had to come to that office on your own accord, and that's the point. It's you and only you have to make the choice to go in or not. After mustering up all the testosterone that my little balls could muster, I walked in the door. I opened the door, and this man stands up, and I shit you not, imagine Tom Cruise on steroids. What I think happened here, this is what I think. After reading it aloud the second time, I think that he got that software called Dragon. And he is just taking a couple beers, and he's just telling this voice software his story.
Oh, right. That makes sense.
Right.
So yeah, I think
it's
that's
spoken like conversation.
Yeah, and he's just going through it. You've got to read this. I haven't even gotten to the boot camp part yet. It's just unbelievable story after unbelievable story. It's legitimately perfect. You know, I was telling you guys that I think that it is like Jarhead. I think this will be the Pogues Jarhead because it is the most Pogue story. He wants to join the military. He thinks that the infantry is what sounds sexy to him, but then he Googled what the infantry does and he said that he doesn't like to hike and fuck that, it sounds lame or whatever. So he wanted to go into tanks. And next thing you know, he's just in a motor pool. That's yeah. The type of dude this is. I cannot wait to talk to
and
Dathan
it's truthful.
On the podcast.
I like that he says, you know, the stories that you hear are the brave, crazy ones. And he's like, ultimately, though, that's not the bulk of it. It's these basic-ass stories like this. So.
Stupid stuff.
And Kate, how many times have you heard stories like this? Like, he talks about going to MEPS, which he says that because he fucked up and forgot to bring different paperwork, he has to go 10 separate times.
Oh, yeah.
to MEPS, which is insane.
Oh, yeah.
So he says that at one point, his recruiter, the first time he goes to MEPS, the recruiter goes to McDonald's and makes him pay for himself. Like, and you would think the government would take care of that McDonald's for you. He's like, I had $20 to my name and I had to stay there for 3 days and eat nothing but McDonald's. It was bullshit.
Oh yeah. He tells the truth. This is what I would say. If you're like looking to go enlisted, like read this book, honestly, because it's probably much more true. Especially with the spelling errors, makes it real.
I respect that he even did it. 'Cause I think a lot of people will say, oh, I'm going to write a book one day, and then it never comes to fruition. So the fact that he followed through and put a book out there, albeit self-published on Amazon, I think is very admirable of this young man. And you can win with guys like that.
Final note, yep. Dathan Beach. What a name.
Yeah.
Dathan with a D? Dathan Beach? Get out
of
here.
Do you think that is a pen name, or is that his actual name?
No, I looked at his LinkedIn. He's real.
And that's another thing that makes me think that this is not a troll at all.
No, it's, trust me, guys. You're talking to Rabbit Hole Kate here. I've done my research. This guy is authentic for sure. So
over the next couple of weeks, I want to walk you through chapter by chapter. We went through MEPS. These are the chapters that he has. Chapter 1, joining. Chapter 2, boot camp. Chapter 3, boot leave and MCT. Chapter 4, Camp Johnson. Chapter 5, Christmas and New Year's 2012. Chapter 6, the end of Camp Johnson. Then visiting home, Kay Bay, Hawaii. And then my favorite one, when we get to chapter 11, 21, and Saturdays are for the boys.
There we go. There we go.
Brick by brick, Dathan Beach. My goodness. So,
Dathan long Beach. Long time stoolie. Long time Dathan Beach. Only had a couple pictures up on his Instagram, and I saw one was a Saturdays for the boys flag. Can't wait to have him on the show. It's going to be wonderful. One last story that I want to tell you about real quick as my save round. There is a former Navy SEAL who is going to Yale at the age of 52 years old. He is going to be a freshman. His name is James Hatch, and he's going to be a freshman at Yale University. And this is after he got out of the Navy after doing 26 years as a SEAL, fighting in places like Afghanistan, amongst other hot spots. His career ended after he was seriously wounded in 2009 during a mission to find Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who had walked off his post. An incredible story, an incredible journey. He talks about how he suffered from post-traumatic stress, fell into drinking and drug use, and even attempted suicide, but he got back on the right track. He's going to school to go to Yale, and going to a school like Yale at 52 years old and being able to exercise those brain muscles, mm-hmm. Oh boy, better man than me. No shot I could do that now.
Well, he's finding his end. He's finding his end, going back to school and getting that degree.
And going to Yale with that big of a frame of reference, probably going to be such a valuable experience for him. That's awesome. Yeah. So good luck.
Yeah.
Good
so huge shout out to him. He's going to be doing great things, I'm sure, after he's done. His name is James Hatch. Maybe we'll try to get him on the show too. Any save rounds, alibis for you guys?
Just quick thing for Fort Stewart, Parris Island, Beaufort, all these places evacuating ahead of Hurricane Dorian. The logistics of that, getting that foot on you last second, having to get all these bases cleared out, and then you don't know where the storm's going and what's happening. So to be a recruit and have to be doing all this traveling and shit with your DIs watching you, I don't know. I just can't imagine what that's like. So
police calling all the rain, putting the rain in your cargo pocket.
Right, putting all that rain in your cargo pocket's absolutely insane. And also a major shout out to our U.S. Coast Guard. Admiral Carl Schultz said that we are responding to help the Bahamian people.
Bahamian.
Good Lord.
Bahamian.
In the wake, and it showed video of helicopters, and this was 2 days ago. I mean, like, as the hurricane's still finishing out, there was Coast Guard helicopters landing on the Bahamas to help people. So I know there's probably a ton of missions gearing up and getting underway to go provide some relief to people who so desperately need it. So shout out to them.
That's always crazy to me, the Coast Guard, because I can remember back to being in Iraq, and if there was dust storms or bad weather, whatever, choppers were grounded, right? And now these guys know there's terrible weather and they're flying right into it.
Yeah.
So that takes a lot of cojones, which is also very well depicted in the movie The Guardian.
Oh, yeah, with Ashton absolutely. Kutcher.
So please watch that. My save round, obviously you mentioned Army beat Rice. Didn't play that well, so hopefully we play better this weekend. But I feel disgusting. And I just ate too much. Starting Thursday night, I just ate too much the last few days. Mm-hmm. And I didn't do enough physical activity. So I just feel gross.
Yeah.
So we need to get that right, and thank God summer's over, because I can't afford.
Can we do some kind of fitness like challenge between the four of us? Brent doesn't count. No. He's actually kind of
I'll
fit.
Never run.
Ugh, like some
you don't think
loss?
I'm fit?
No, you're fit, but like you're big boned fit. You know, you're like a little chunk to your stonk.
I think, but I've always been like that. even when I was like younger, I was always kind of thick.
No, you're very fit, I guess.
No, you don't have to say I'm very fit, but right. I'm just saying I'd be willing to do something like that. You know what I would love to do with you guys is a Tough Mudder, because those are a blast. I would love to sign up and do one as a squad.
Chaps don't run. It would take us 5 hours because Chaps would refuse.
He would just walk each obstacle. Yeah. Maybe you, me, and Brent can do it, and Chaps can just pull out a chair and just cheer us from the sidelines. Yeah. You guys are doing amazing.
Well, yeah, if you have any tips to help us get less gross, hit us up at ZeroBlog30.
I spent 7 hours in a lazy river over the course of Labor Day weekend, so that was wonderful.
That's great.
Yeah, I liked your tweet. You're like, taking a break from the lazy river, regrouping, trying to relax so I can head back in there. Like, yeah, that must be so tough, asshole.
Yeah, it was definitely tough. All right, it's on the retreat.